Accession number 10165, reel number 17.
Martin McLean, reel 17. You were telling me about the stevedores, Liverpool stevedores, that were engaged in the landing at Saint-Nazaire.
Well, their job, obviously, was to unload the Wallach stores and the big lorries, the motorbikes. And these vehicles we used to have to take great care with. You know, if we scratched them, if we broke anything or damaged anything, we had to put accident reports in and such things like that. And you should have seen the way the stevedores would bundle them out of the ship. For instance, the motorcycles, about five motorcycles put in a net, just a scramble net, and hooked up. The brake cables were jammed in each other, bent and broken. When they come down, there was more time spent on repairs to them than anything else. Whereas I think they could have been more careful. And all they wanted to do was unload the ship, and that was then finished. They also had big cans of petrol, like a big square tin, and they were putting lots of them in one of these nets. And I don't know what they're doing with them down below, but when they came out, they were pouring petrol all over the shop. If anybody had been there with a match or any ignition, the whole ship would have ended up now in anything else. Anyway, we got our stock away. But before this, we landed in France, and we were put in an incomplete cinema. That was a big terrace thing, like an amphitheatre set of cement steps in this empty, bare, derelict, desolate, cold building. We were really at war now. We knew we were roughing it. And we got a little space for it to sleep in until such a time as the ship did come in with us with materials. And we got out in the streets and had a look at the French, and we weren't very much impressed. There's thousands of French soldiers milling about with their hands in their pockets and slouching around with cigarettes in their mouths. Not like the discipline that we were, disciplined men, you know, swing with arms up and marching like a soldier, like a soldier. We dropped into a more slovenly habits later on during the war, but at this time we're all button stick soldiers. And to see the state of the French army, my own impression, and I make no bones on this, I said, them blokes is not going to fight. No intention. Anyway,
did you get any sort of reception from the French when you arrived?
None at all. We just landed we were all eyes at the place, landing in a strange port, you know, and the grimaces and the marks, they welcomed us all right, in a sort of way, a friendly way, but we didn't have any contact with them. And we went out in the streets and we went into the bars and had a glass of their beer. But the surprising thing, everybody used to drink wine there, and our lads were looking for beer. Those who drank wine really took ill. And it was during this time, we had no cooks, we had no food, we had nothing. We had to go and scrounge rations and go and onto our lorries that had the cooking equipment on and get the cooking equipment off and provide our own cook and material. Lads who didn't cook before now enlisted to do the cooking. We all mucked in. Our favourite was brewing up tea. No bother with these new paraffin petrol burners we had. Just like a big Bunsen blow lamp. And the stands for put them on. And square Dixies. We used to have the round Dixies previous to that. Well, oblong. And we used to put them on these things for the boil up tea, and we start opening meat and stuff and buying stuff and making ourselves meals. Some of us went down with food poisoning, and I was one of them eventually. I have no doubt of that, because although we're cooking, the cleanliness of the place didn't lend to much good cooking, and our skills was much the same. We got our stuff off, and I set up for the column, and I was in charge of all the motorbikes.
Hang on, can I just put the date on this? Now, you came across on roughly when?
I've got a card in there which I posted off on the day I left Bristol to the wife, and it was around about the 6th of September. Around about that day, I couldn't guarantee, but it's approximate that date. That's in 1939.
Just to pick up one other point. When you'd done the crossing, had you any fear of intervention of any sort, submarines or mines, or were you escorted?
We were escorted, funny enough. The destroyers, plenty of destroyers them days, plenty of them, nothing to do. They were just escorting us across the channel. And it was nice to look out on the ship, first ship I'd been on, watching the escort, the destroyers flashing past and coming back, and you know, and the whole hurly-burly. Every moment on the ship was a great experience, I thought. I had more of it later on, but that was my first experience. But the French, the outstanding thing in my mind was, they had toilets for men, and they were just like a round steel pillbox, and you could smell them miles away. They must have stunk for years, and you could smell them a mile away. And also the cigarettes that the French smoked, you could smell them a mile away also. And anyway, we got to know the French, and we were more or less down the docks all the time, waiting for our stuff coming off. So I got all the motorcycles off, and we set off to go travel north up to the borders of France and Belgium to a place called Nomien. That was where the where the battalion was in the second div build-up, near a place called Mouchin, through Douai, they called it. Go through Douai, and then you're nearly into Nomien, and it's the next one is the border, which is Mouchin.
Hang on, there's just... last time we talked, I thought you, from after you got food poisoning, you went on a rail detail party to Nantes.
That's it, yes. Thanks for putting us right. All the transport didn't come into Saint-Nazaire. Some came into Nantes. And the officer in charge of the transport, he said, Sergeant McLean, look, he says that some of the transport, the command officer's car and other items have come into Nantes and the motorcycles. You're the motorcycle man. You take the drivers and the motorcyclists into Nantes and see what you can do about getting the transport out. Now, you've got to make... told me the directions. Well, we're all trained in this thing, so it was just like giving us orders what to do to get them to Nomien. Nomien's a feeding. Nomien's just get there. There was supposed to be staging camps on the way, but I never hit with any. Went to Nantes and went in the dockyards, and not a thing moving. All the boats were still derelict. And I asked what was happening. The stevedores had been inoculated against bubonic plague and against TB inoculation against the things you used to get off lice. I forget what it is anyway. It was very infectious, and they were very careful in the army, so that they inoculated all these people against it. Typhus. And they inoculated all the lads. Well, when you get inoculated with a typhus inoculation, it does really upset you, and you get a 48 hours execute duty. But in the war, that's waived. There's no execute duty. You just get on with it like a soldier wounded. You get on with it. But the doctors had decided that they weren't going to work, and they packed in work. And there's all the derricks and everything idle. So I got some of our men together, and I had also with us Lieutenant Best of the Royal Welsh Fusiliers and some of the Royal Berkshire with him, because we're in the same brigade. Our vehicles, the posh vehicles, had gone in a special boat which has landed up in Nantes. And we got on talking, and I said to the lieutenant, I said, well, why don't we try to get them off ourselves? Well, I'd seen a lot of the stevedores on working on the quayside. I told you, as a young lad, I used to dawdle along the quay wanting to go on the ships, and I'd seen how they unloaded boats and what have you, or ships, well, we always call them boats. And so I said, well, why don't we go and see the ship's captain and see if we can get our own ship stuff off? I said, they might be fighting up the front by the time. That's the very words I use. They might be fighting by the time we get up there. You know, we didn't want to miss anything. So we all, the sergeants and him, went and had a chat with the ship's captain. And he was only two. Please don't load his ship. He got the ship's crew on, and they were working the winches and the derricks. And we were down in the holes, putting the nets. We'd seen how the others done it. And there was a sailor there to advise us. And we're putting the cars and the motorbikes in a bit more respectable order, by the way, into the nets, because they were our own motorcycles, and getting them off the boat and storing them. And we worked till we cleared the boat of the Royal Welsh Fusiliers and Burkes and stuff kit. So we hit the road to go up the Nomien, all very anxious to pass through away from Saint-Nazaire and get up to the battalion, that's where the lads were. So I took charge of all the motorcyclists, and all the motor convoys set off, and we were ahead of them. And I felt ill, and I stopped the motorbike, or else I fell off it. And I had a series of a bad bout of food poisoning. And they took me into hospital, and I stayed there for 2 or 3 days till it cleared up. And then I joined them again, and I made my way to Nomien with a battalion. And I still found some of the remnants of the transport to pick up and go through, and we went through with it. and we'll land up the battalion of no man in a derelict, dirty, scruffy-looking village. Nothing, you've never seen nothing like it in your life. We got shoved into a farmhouse, and they have a square of buildings, in which includes the farmhouse and the farm buildings, and they do make a square with an archway leading through to them. And right in the centre there, they have a huge dung heap, which is cows, pigs, horses, human excreta, and everything is in there. And in there, they have a cesspool. All the drainage off there goes into a cesspool, which the farmer drains off in a great big barreled thing and takes it on the field and waters the field with it without any diluting. And the smell and the pong of the air, it was terrific. Mate, no wonder we've got curly hair. And they do this, and I was very... I said, surely this is not a civilised country. I got on well on with the farmer and his family, and this, that and the other, but then came the order. Troops would carry on preparing defences. And so they start, they give us defensive positions to dig in the borderline. We had to march to it each morning, march out with the, no overalls like we used to have, the canvas suits. And the only suit that we had of khaki. They took all the other stuff off us, just had one suit of khaki, with a battle order, a steel helmet, and a hat, another hat. And we had a blanket as well. And all our, like, marching orders, they call it, knife, fork, spoon, and the brush, comb, lather brushes, and all that sort of stuff. And we lived in the farmer's barn, and we used to march off to these digging areas, as we call them, and we might be digging for a company, or putting apron wire fencing up. That's the barbed wire fencing that we used to be trained with in peacetime, like putting curled spikes in and making the barbed wire up in the aprons, as they call it. It's a defensive thing. Or we could be on helping to prepare minefields or helping to dig anti-tank ditches. My platoon, being the mortar platoon, didn't have any specific task apart from our own positions. And so we got used to get shoved all over the shop digging, including the platoon commander, which is Harry Qualthrough. And we used to go off digging these sessions, and the weather was foul. It started getting all the snow and rain. Still went off every morning, slopping through the water, up the knees in mud. I mean that, really up the... Everything was flooded. The place we're digging in was, it seemed to be a waterlogged area and sandy area without any drainage. And the place was in an awful state. I was going to say hell of a state. But anyway, we had to get out every morning and do this. And
how,
you know...
How did you dig a mortar position?
Well...
What exactly would it look like?
It was just like digging a square hole, a deep square hole, with other communication trenches off, where you could plant a mortar in, and it could shoot over the top and fire at the enemy. Because you needed quite a space for it, because when you have the tripod mounted, that is the gun mounted, you have three men standing around it, and one, and then you have the ammunition in another little bay, where the men is feeding it. They carry the shells, the bombs, back and forward to feed the gun in the event of having to use them. So it's like a square hole that we had, a bit deeper than the others, so that the muzzle of the mortar didn't be seen shown above.
About how deep would you say?
I'd say we made ours a good 6 foot deep. And in 6 foot deep, I mean, it's not just a hole dug in the ground. We put revetments in. Now, a revetment means brush apron tied in with steel wires and wire outside that we've been taught to do in peacetime to prevent the mud sliding and the rubbish sliding on. And we also had a fire step in case we had to get up and fire wherever. So you have your trench, and you have a deep part where you're down and below, and then you have a fire bay. In the event of an attack, you get up on the fire bay where you can lean over the parapet and shoot with your rifle or weapons, wherever it may be. And so all this digging was just a day-long series of hard work. Saturdays and Sundays was exactly the same. Everybody out digging, everybody involved in it. And then you'd find your own quarter guard. They still had the quarter guards in front of the order room, for they said for a matter of discipline. And you'd come in from a digging area, and next day you'd find your own quarter guard, and you're scruffy, wet, clean, and everything. You had to turn out spick and span on the guard mountain. You had to dry your clothing off in front of the bits of fires we had, scrub the mud off, and some took some shift, and it was a yellowish mud. And someone, I know his son very, very well now, a fellow called Donaldson, who was in A Company, We didn't use the blanco or equipment or clean the brasses. That was all part of the dulling up for war. You didn't spit and polish. But this lad got some of this yellow clay that we're working on so frivolously, day in, day out, and he blancoed his equipment with it. And I must say, it made a remarkable appearance from our greased, dirty-looking equipment that we had. So the order came out that everybody had a blanco with this stuff, so he was given his blessings. I know his son very well. I saw his son once come in the club where I was at, and I said, he looks familiar. Turned out it was Sergeant Donaldson's son. Anyway, that's another story not involved with this. And so the whole battalion, if we're on quarter guard, you had to blanco up, clean up, polish, and be on quarter guard with your pack on your back and great coat because the weather was off.
You still have the stick, man?
Same thing for a stick man, yes. But they were a bit more lenient. It couldn't possibly turn out with all the spit and Spanish and the polished shoes. But you had to clean up blackened boots, dubbins part of the boot, polished toes and heels. We had two pair of boots. That was the only second thing we carried. And we used to have to turn out in reasonable condition, clean condition, smart. And you were inspected as normal.
What were you... So you spent all day doing this, the digging of positions. What were your conditions of service like at the billets? What did you have, a bed, or were you just on the floor in the barn? Or what?
Very, very primitive. A hay barn. We were just lying on the hay. We had one blanket and nothing else. No change. So what happened was the men were taking their boots and putties off and sleeping in their khaki. You couldn't do any of that. It was so cold. You pulled a blanket over you. And as the weather got worse, you could wake up in the morning and is seeing this barn frost over the top of the blankets. It became so cold. And in the barn, you had no means of heating. Maybe outside they'd have a brazier going, which they had to buy the coke and the fuel for it themselves, that it chip in. So you can imagine there was very little stuff of that, very little of that got. So we had a very primitive condition. We're living in mess tins.
How many would be in this barn?
The whole platoon plus the empty platoon. So I'd say there's about, in this barn, about 60, 70 men.
And you as a sergeant were in there with
them? In there with them, yes. We lived in, from now on, we were with the men. There's no sergeant's messes or anything of that. But officers and WOs, they were billeted out into houses in the area.
Where were the rest of the battalion then?
All in the same sort of barns and hovels and outhouses.
In no main?
In no main. In some in very poor conditions. We were lucky. We were above the cattle buyers, and the cattle buyers, the heat comes off them a bit. So you can imagine, there was still frost on top of us. What was it like then? Poor people who were down on ground level with one blanket, so they were worse off. Matter of fact, I'm telling you about the coal, they were like egg things that they were making in England from coal dusts. I told you about my mother dying. They used to press these things together and wet them and dry them and put them on to make a fire. Well, unbeknownst to people, they got old oil cans, knocked holes in them, and put them in their billets. Those that didn't have straw, we had straw, we couldn't put one in. And there was one incident whereby there was about 8 men overcome by the fumes and nearly killed them. Some lads in the BEF did die through the same thing. The fumes of the little coal balls that we used to make for the burn were so highly monoxide gases that they killed them in these enclosed billets because they had no windows, the doors were shut, keeping the warmth of the drafts out. Some of them died. Now, I don't know many, but not so many, but the regulations came in force once in the battalion. Once we had it, some near escapes, then fires out of billets during the night time or sleeping times.
What was your food like?
Food was pretty grim. Again, we've got to have a sack ration of sorts to go out on the digging area. Sometimes just the hard biscuits and corned beef. Hard biscuits were these very hard things that if you didn't have reasonable teeth to tell, tall, you couldn't get through them. They were hard as granite.
Well, like dog biscuits are now.
Harder, squarer, much larger. I can show you upstairs, I've got there now an emergency ration of a soldier in the Boer War. I received it from somewhere, and it's a huge square biscuit. Well, ours was much the same, but a little less in size.
About 4 inches square?
About 3 inches square. And we had quite a lot. You'd get 4 or 5 of these, and you'd get some corned beef, a tin of corned beef for so many men. That was your haversack ration. And we used to go working very hard in these conditions. And when we came back, there'd be a dinner, but it was always a stew. because they didn't have the cooking facilities then, did they? They had to cook out in the open. They had the blow lamps for heating and cooking, but they had to cook for a whole battalion. So we got fed, one company feeding, by the way. So there'd be about 200 men with all the MT and the carrier platoon and us and all the others in the headquarter company. So although the cooks had experience in cooking in cookhouses in England and on exercise, or cooking day-to-day, every day, every meal on these stoves, we'd get a bit of bacon for breakfast, if we're lucky, or a boiled egg. You could say an egg fried solid, like rubber, because they've been cooked so long. Cooks couldn't do any other. They'd fry them over open stoves, and they just, once they were cooked, they flung them aside, and you got one, and a slice of bread, and that was your lot, and a margarine, a bit of jam, maybe, if you're lucky. But we weren't fed at all well.
Were you actually hungry then?
Very hungry. So much so, that is where the majority of any money that we had left went. We used to go off to No Main and buy anything that we could get to eat.
You got paid then? You got your pay?
We got our weekly pay. Of course, all the lads who had stoppages, like married, I was married, stoppages taken off, and you got the remnants of your money, or you get what you asked for. Like, you've got to save a little to go on leaves and things like that. You've got to have a little standby. So you'd say to the pier sergeant, or the secret mess then who used to do the pier, I'm on 6 bob a week. The rest, just put away for us. 6 bob a week was a lot of money, because you consider that a lad wasn't getting much. I think I was getting 3 and 6, or about 4 and 6 months a day as a fully-fledged sergeant. That's with all the fishery grants and shooting grants and everything. Which is a lot of money, really, you know, them days. So I could make Annie a reasonable allowance and keep a bit for when I went on leaves and have a little for myself. So it all went on food. Even if it wasn't food, it was apples or of that nature, you know, fruit.
Well, now, you worked all day. What time would you start in the morning?
Well, we're back very early in the morning. First light, you could see everybody's on the move. It was no good getting up in the dark winter days during the dark mornings, because you couldn't see. We had lamps, but they were pretty lenient then. We'd all be off on our way to work by 9 o'clock in the morning, 8 o'clock, 9 o'clock in the morning.
And you'd work till...
And we'd march off maybe 3, 4, 5, maybe more miles. Or I've seen the whole battalion being taken away on another task, digging. The whole battalion have to march. Or they took the battalion away on a battalion route march or an exercise. But we're kept busy all of the time in the main, digging and preparing defences.
And what time in the day would you be free?
Well, I'd say we came back in time for dinner at the battalion headquarters. That, I'd say, we'd start marching back about 4 or 5 o'clock at night. And this, in the later days, would stay later. Yeah. In the winter.
When would you get the chance to go to No Main then? You'd be free once you got
back. Every night time. Yes, every night.
Was everyone allowed into No Main?
Yes, there's no restriction.
Quarter guard?
The quarter guard couldn't move. The quarter guard was stuck there. And anyone on regimental duties was stuck there. But after all, we're living in No Main, and No Main is just an addition of the built area we were. So the lads used to go to No Main. Some lucky blighters used to get on the army trucks and go off to Dewey. They used to put our passion wagons on, and they used to go off to Dewey, and they had a cinema there, French cinema, but they showed British captions on the bottom. I went there a couple of times. Just showed the ordinary English film, but they were adapted for French speaking, and so they put English on the bottom for us.
Did they show any British newsreel films? You know, the war film?
Very few. There was no war then. It was a Cold War, wasn't it? They'd show you maybe aircraft flying over and maybe bombing a submarine or a ship shooting up with somebody else, but there was no action as such that we saw.
You mentioned the passion wagons. Did many of the men take advantage of the brothels in Douai, or were there any in No Main?
Well, there was none in No Main. A pretty religious little place was No Main. But I never went down to Douai. Only on two occasions I went down with some of the lads who went to the pictures. I had no interest in the place at all. Being a young married man, I wasn't interested. But yes, the others did go. Now, I'll pass a report here, which I think the powers that be in the army today should take note of it and all. And this is not only my opinion, it's the opinion of a lot of old W's and sergeants who have the experience of handling men. We are training and doing all this work, and on Monday morning, you'd find these men all sultry and sullen and coming off to work, you know, and they'd fight over the least little thing. Well, when they were lured away to brothels, the difference in their men of a Monday morning, all bright and keen and ready to go to work, and also ready for to go on the next weekend. So, although I'm a religious background, I'd say wherever there's men in such huge quantities as they have there and deny them the rights of women, I think it's all wrong. There should be legalised brothels. I make no bones on that. I found that my men were fitter, they're more intelligent and more willing to work than had been previous to this. We won't go into medical reasons why, but we know we've got better results from the men when these facilities were available for the men.
Was there much problem with VD at this early stage of the war?
Very little. It so happens, the stories are, the troops could only go to legalised brothels and the women were inspected. There was a case of VD, the backstreet lads with the backstreet women, but not many. Everyone was pretty well warned about the seriousness of catching VD. As a matter of fact, they were so serious with you, it halved your pay. It took your efficiency pays and all sorts of grants off you if you caught VD. So men were more careful about these sort of things. Some of the couldn't care less people accepted.
When you went into Nomain for more food, what sort of place would you go to? What was it, a cafe or a restaurant, or what was it?
A weeny little cafe, come bar. You could get beer and stuff. You could get sandwiches of sorts. I can't remember much of it because I didn't have. I used to put myself on a restricted budget, and I wouldn't spend money on French food. Having had me whack of getting a food poison, remember in a previous statement, and even that drink I would hardly touch, and I had it really bad, this food poison, and it learnt me a lesson. So I kept off the food a lot. I think if I went for anything, I'd go for fruit, apples and oranges. Pretty expensive, but still, they were filling. Bananas. And you didn't see much of them either.
Where would they sell them at?
They'd sell them in little fruiteries. And of course, in France, you could get plenty of apples because they used to grow all over the shop. In the trees along the roads, you'd find apples wherever you went, in abundance.
Would you help yourself in those circumstances?
We did on occasions, yes. Grapes is another thing, plenty of grapes, but not where we were, not in Nomain, because the fields had been stripped bare for the forces, and it wasn't a wine grown area. But coming through in the transport, we noticed the vineyards, and we did get plenty of grapes there. Fruit I used to live on, and I used to like it, make no bones about it. It was a filler.
So you wouldn't go to these cafe cum bars very often?
No, you couldn't afford it. The beer was very cheap. I'll tell you what we used to go into these places for. Rum and coffee. A cup of coffee with rum lacing, as they call it. And we used to call them coffee ole, silver player. Well, that was the favourite cry, coffee ole. And out would come the cup of black coffee with its rum in, and we'd sit there and drink it. It's nice warmer in the cold weather. That was about the only things I really went in the cafes for.
Who, you'd go with your fellow NCOs, would you?
Yes. We were back to that state where we went out, went with a W or a sergeant. Or on your own. There was no stipulation, but you more or less tend to keep your own kin. We had a little sergeant's mess there. And I'll tell you a little amusing incident there. Once I went along, they're having a bit of a party. Don't know what it was about, but the mayor of Nomain showed up. And he's a little farmer man or a blacksmith. I'm not sure what he was. But they got the champagne bottles out. Now, champagne was very cheap, let's face it. About 8 pence or 5 pence a bottle. And they got the champagne out for this occasion. And the mayor of Nomain was in this white suit. Well, you can imagine, these roads that were on were just a single cambered road of cobbles. And they were for a horse and cart. Well, the big army lorries passing back and forward and passing each other had got on the side, which was plenty of room on the side, and churned the whole of the area into one big quagmire of mud. Anyway, in this place, we're having a bit of a sing-song, and this mayor was having a singing, the Marseillaise. We're having a rip-roaring good night this night. I don't. Maybe we're celebrating somebody's promotion. Maybe my own. I couldn't remember. But I was now promoted PSM. I was taken over the platoon sergeant major. I was moved on from platoon sergeant to platoon sergeant major. But anyway, the mayor was there, and he went out to have a run off. Now, toilets is that men's notes. You go outside, and this old mayor came in, walking along, straddle legged. He'd fell face down in the mud, drunk of course, and his white suit was all covered in mud, all the front and the back was all white. And we had a good laugh at it, but he stayed the night with us. What a state he was in! Yes, I'd been promoted from sergeant to PSM now.